Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello and welcome to another episode of The Lab. I'm joined by Ben White and we're going to be talking about financial fair play, PSR rules and how they impact Tottenham. But before I do it, can you introduce yourself, Ben, because I'll butcher it if you leave it to me.
Yeah, no worries. So in terms of who I am, probably more importantly who I'm not, because I don't want to sort of missell myself, but I'm a big Spurs fan, obviously. Spurs fan since the 90s, your HPs and Hewlett-Packard days with... you know, Anderton, Mabbott, that sort of business. So I endured all the 90s, 2000s, all through the Enoch era. But then coupled with that, I'm someone who's got probably a sad level of interest in football finance. So comes from, I'm not an accountant, but did like a business degree, finance degree, a couple of investment qualifications and have worked for KPMG. So they're an accounting firm, but I was on the consulting side, working with companies a bit like Enoch a lot of the time. So private equity firms, investment management firms, doing all sorts of projects. So yeah, corporate restructuring and cost management, that sort of thing, strategy, definition, all those sort of projects. So all fairly boring stuff, but it all sort of ties back into this sort of interest in football finance. And especially given we're, you know, owned by an investment company, all the financial stuff around the stadium. So tied all that together. And then I sort of subscribe to people like your Swiss Rambles, like the real professionals, your Swiss Rambles, your Kieran Maguire's, Price of Football. So they're the ones that really dive into the depth. And then what I do is sometimes try and summarize it because I know a lot of people find the area quite confusing, don't have the background or the interest or whatever it may be. So they just want the so what, like what does it mean for Spurs? So, I've done a couple of posts like that, a couple of threads.
That's
the one you saw, isn't it?
While we're having a conversation, yeah. And a lot of this will be that. So what does that mean for Spurs, if that's all right?
Yeah. No problem at all.
Yeah, so you do it for a living and then you thought, I need more of this.
Yeah.
I need more of this.
I need more of this.
Investment firm. Like, how does Spurs structurally, how is Tottenham different from other football clubs? So there might be similar entities out there as well, but
they're similar to some.
Yeah. What you say it's an investment firm, is it they've invested in Spurs to one day make a profit and sell the club? That's the aim.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so ultimately they're owned by, I can't remember the exact percentages, but majority owned by Enoch, as we all know, which is owned by 30% Levy and I think 70% Lewis, but Lewis owns it through Tavistock Group, which he set that up with a load of other investors. There's dozens of them, but they've got investments not just in Spurs, that invests in I don't know how many other companies, but it's got all sorts of different companies, not just sports. They're invested across the world. Got billions, I think it might be hundreds of billions, invested. And that's how Lewis is the ultimate owner, because Tavistock own Enoch owns Spurs. And it's fairly typical for an investment structure, like all your private equity companies and things like that. There are some other football clubs like that as well, so it's not unusual. I know people are sort of suspicious of all the different corporate entities they've set up beneath Spurs and stuff, but it all rolls up. All the money the club makes rolls up to the club. It's just that they're the shareholder, and as you say, they benefit at the end when they sell. So they can't take any money now, because if they do, they only Enoch own, what is it, 78%? So they've got all the voting power. If they pay a dividend, they can only pay themselves 80% of that. The rest of it has to go. All these other, you know, smaller private shareholders that are knocking about.
So they, what you're saying there is that the Enoch and Daniel Levy have never taken money out of the club as profit. They've apart from wages and the insane amount that he paid. I don't know. Is that an insane amount for some?
It's debatable. To us, it seems, he's the highest paid in the league by some distance. Was it something like 6 million bonus and salary this last year gone?
Right.
So he does get paid a lot. He gets paid more than any other chairman, but it's not wild figures compared to other CEOs that are making. He's ultimately he's working for the shareholders, and he's accountable to the board. And what they're going to want to see, the shareholders are investors. You know, what they want to see is that the revenue grow and the value of their investment, their shares grow. So he's doing his job from that perspective. Might not be what we want. You know, we want success on the field, but. Mm. His bonuses can't really be tied to success on the field, because there's too many factors involved. So that's what his targets will be. He's hit them. He's got his revenue boost. It doesn't sit well with us, maybe, but you know, they're not crazy figures, really. When you look at other CEOs that are getting 20, 30 million a year for similar sort of percentage rises, it's not that eye watering.
Yeah, so just to be clear, the Enoch have never taken any money out of the club, because it would be they would 20% of it would have to go to other shareholders.
Yeah, exactly, because they don't own all of the shares, and you have to pay them out equally among all the shareholders. So
right.
So they depending on the share type, so they can't just siphon money. You know, everyone, you get this thing, Daniel Levy's pocketing the money. He can't pocket the money. He gets his money through salary. Joe Lewis so far has got no money out of it. It's just that when they sell, Joe Lewis technically has handed shares to a trust or whatever, but.
Obviously,
that's when they get their money.
Without trying to be morbid, Joe Lewis, you'd imagine, now that he's escaped prison anyway, he's coming towards the end of his life, you'd imagine.
86?
Yeah, he's an old man. He's an old man. Do you think that there would be pressure from him to get the club sold before he, you know, is he future planning, or is it just insignificant to his overall?
Yeah, I assumed he would. Like, going back 5 years or so, I was thinking, well, surely now they open the stadium, it's worth all this money, surely that's when they sell. But he doesn't seem that fast, because, he's handed his trust. He's probably still got influence over this family trust that he's given the shares to, but he's no longer legally the direct owner of those shares. His daughter, and he's there's two people, one related to him, that sort of control it. Hmm. And I think his daughter or his niece have got the beneficial ownership. So, yeah, he doesn't seem that fast. He has got a lot of money. He only got slapped with a silly, what was it, £5 million fine or something, which is, dropping the ocean to him. So maybe he doesn't care. Maybe he's happy without it. But that could be related to the rumours we're hearing about your investment, maybe.
Okay, well, we'll be talking about that. But as we stand, what are the rules with financial fair play and Premier League spending? And if you can, what can you differentiate between the two?
Yeah, sure. So, it'll be a bit of it's quite detailed, so I'll break it down, shoot in with questions as and when they pop up.
Yeah, but sort of as top line.
I'll give you
a
bit of a summary of it, yeah. So I guess first thing, FFP and PSR, they're basically the same thing. So financial fair play and profit and sustainability rules, they're pretty much referring to the same thing. So FFP came in, it was a UEFA thing. They brought it back in 2009, 2010, I think it was. And what they basically said was that costs are spiraling. It was backdrop of the financial crisis in 2007, 2008. They said that costs are going crazy in football. Salaries are rising, transfers are rising, companies going out of business left, right and centre. Need to get a bit of a handle on it. It doesn't look great that football's spending all this money. So they brought in this concept of 3 years. So clubs file their accounts every year, and they said over any three-year period, you can't lose more than €5 million. And that limit goes up to €35 million if your owners are willing to give you the extra 35 million. So you can, so European clubs, they said that's the rule now, 5 million euros or 35 if your owners are involved, that's the lot. Premier League then looked at that and said, seems sensible, we'll bring it in as well. So they voted a couple of years later, I think it's 2012. They needed a majority vote to get it in. And this is the irony of clubs like Newcastle complaining. They were one of the clubs that voted it in. Spurs voted it in as well. I think it got 13 out of 19. Reading didn't bother voting. Everyone else did. Man City didn't want it, obviously. Some weird clubs didn't want it, like Fulham, West Brom, Southampton. But everyone else said, yeah. So they all voted it in. All the other top six voted it in. And they called it PSR. So that's the only real difference is they said, right, we'll call ours profit and sustainability rules, which is probably a better name. And they said, actually, we're going to allow slightly more losses. So they said, you can lose 15 million per season under our rules. So 15 million for the 3-year cycle over under our rules instead of 5 million euros. But we'll let you lose 35 million a season if your owners will back that. So it can't just be loans. It has to be like that to buy new shares, basically give you the money. So yeah, so the Premier League
equates to 105.
105 million over any 3-year cycle. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So it's a rolling thing. So it's not like 3 years, then the next three, it's, you know, constant. 21, yeah. 22, 23, and then 22, 23, 24, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, so pretty much the same. And the idea behind allowing the increased losses was that not all of our clubs are in Europe. So, you know, it's a bit of a disadvantage to the clubs outside of Europe. They don't get the revenue, but they do get the same loss limits. So we'll let you lose a bit more if your owners want to, you know, be ambitious and spend. But the reality is all the clubs use it. So it's no greater advantage to them, really. But that was the thinking behind it.
Okay.
Yeah, they're your headline rules. They're you can lose 105 million in the league over 3 years. That's it. But the two things to note, which sometimes confuses people, are the allowable losses. So you're allowed to deduct any spending on things like women's football, infrastructure. So obviously big one for us with the stadium. There's a couple of like youth football, things like that. So anything you spent on that, say you lose 200 million in a year, which, you know, far off what we lost. You could say, well, actually, we spent 100 million on the stadium and this and that. So can we deduct all that? And our loss is actually only wherever it may be. So yeah, you're allowed to do that. And they also allow clubs to estimate their pandemic losses and write those off. So I think we estimated 200 million odd and we wrote that off as well. So you can sort of absorb some stuff. Most clubs make a loss. You could do that and then just say, actually, this stuff was good spending.
So in terms of writing off or estimating your losses in the pandemic or because of the pandemic, did that mean that spending rules were pretty much relaxed and non-existent to some degree because it could be manipulated easily? And now that they're gone and there's actual accounting in place and proper bookkeeping in place, does it mean that everyone will be tightening their belts more so because it's in black and white, they can see what they've spent? Whereas before you said there's like this sort of nebulous idea about, oh, well, yeah, the pandemic cost us X amount.
Yeah, exactly. So clubs, they were allowed to estimate it. They didn't really, like, you can't really prove it. Ours were obviously very high, our estimates. So were Man United's, because we make a lot of money through the stadium, or we're planning to at that time. But you did have clubs, you know, take the piss a little bit, like Everton, I think, estimated more losses than us, which is, you know, questionable when they're in a pretty small stadium, not bringing in quite so much. Yeah, so that was one of their things that was questioned. I don't think they actually threw that figure out, but there was some scrutiny over that.
Did Everton vote for it, for these spending rules to be implemented as well?
Everton did vote for it, yeah. Everton, Newcastle, Villa, yeah.
And now the Everton fans are complaining of corruption.
Yeah, exactly, voted. Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
So what are the rule changes in the summer then? What's happening now? Because I was of the position that, well, Daniel Levy's played this, and he may well have done, excellent long game. Spurs are really in a really advantageous situation currently. Chelsea look like their backs are against the walls, and then suddenly they're changing the rules. What are the rule changes?
So I guess the headline is it's not that much different. It's slightly worse for us. I'll explain why, but to do that, our current position is we lost, people have seen the headline from our accounts where we lost quite a bit of money. I think over the last 3-year cycle, we've lost 230 million, which obviously isn't great, but we were off a lot of money every year for infrastructure. So allowable losses for Corona in 2021, infrastructure cost every year, all that written off, we actually made, from a PSR perspective, a profit of about 100 million. So our current position under these rules, which will stay for next season as well, is that we, as of last June, we had about 200 million-ish headroom. So we'd made a PSR profit of 100, plus you're allowed to make 105 million losses. So altogether, 200 million-ish.
What about this 400 million figure that was touted about?
That was touted about.
I've been banging that drum for a long time.
Yeah. It's a slightly out of date figure. So it was true. Obviously, they're all sort of slightly estimated until you get the actual accounts. But we did have that headroom. We had about 5 years where we made like massive profits. I think we're still the most, like, if you take the whole of the Premier League era, we're the most profitable club in the Premier League. So that's something that obviously gets thrown at the owners. Mm. But the 5 years before the stadium, before the pandemic, we're actually booked a profit every year. And since then, we've booked a loss every year. So that 400 million it's just basically slightly out of date. It was taking into account years, you know, two of the earlier years in the cycle where we'd made profits. So we're in the profit, plus you got more money on top. So and
you're saying we're making losses and then profits. What's genuinely, or is it impossible to tell? Are we making a profit or are we making losses in real term?
We're loss making in real term at the moment, which I don't, it does surprise people because obviously everyone, yeah, we've generated all this money from the stadium and stuff like that, but our costs have flown up as well. So operating costs are higher, wages have gone up, I think 20%, they've gone up quite a lot in the year to June. The cost of running the stadium and the events, although we profit from them overall, are quite high. And then our transfer spending just like shot massively up. So people don't always want to hear it, but if you look at the 4 years, 5 years before the stadium, it was something like a net spend of like 50 million. If you look at the 4 or 5 years after, it's a net spend of 550, something like that. So, you know, wages are up, transfer spending's up, and we're not great at selling players. So really the money we're loss making because we're putting a lot of money into A, paying off the stadium, and B, buying players, basically. That's where we're spending it.
Right, so Tottenham do spend money then.
Yeah, categorically do spend money. Maybe it's not as much as we could, but we do.
Well, that's interesting. There are, actually, let me, before going on to that, what are the changing rules then?
New rules. Yeah, so obviously everyone's been moaning about PSR a little bit, or I say everyone, Newcastle, Villa, you know, Barcelona, those sort of players, Chelsea, City, obviously. So there's been a lot of noise about it. There's been some talk about, are the limits enough? Should it be, like, because of inflation for wages and transfers, should it be up at 200 million, 250 million? Don't think it really makes sense under sustainability to say, yeah, you can lose 200 million every year, that's fine. Been other people saying just get rid of it and make the owners like put money aside so that they can't put clubs at risk, which, yeah, maybe. But basically, while all that's been going on, UEFA sat down, looked at theirs and said, should we simplify it a little bit? Because as we've just been through, like, it's quite complicated and there's lots of little, you know, three-year cycles and nuances to it. So they said, let's simplify it. Let's bring in this, confusingly, it's called financial sustainability rules, so FSR. So you've got another one to learn. But it's called the squad cost rule, is what everyone's calling it. And what it is saying that all the money you bring in, you can only spend a certain percentage of that in any given year on transfers, on wages, and on things like, you know, hiring and firing managers. So on your football spend, you can only spend 70% of that. And they're bringing that in slowly. So they've started this season, you can spend 90%. Next season, you can spend 80%. And the season after, 70% cap. Anything above that, you get punished.
And that is good for Tottenham because we generate so much revenue. But
it is, because our costs are still low compared. But the Premier League have basically copied it. So Premier League are doing the same thing. But for Tottenham and for the Premier League, they're saying, yeah, it makes sense. We're going to bring it in, but we'll stick with our own rules for next year. So own rules stick around. They've voted for it, but they haven't yet ratified it. I think it's in June. They've got to rubber stamp it. So it's not definite yet, but it's very likely because I think it was unanimous. And they've got to decide on the punishments. But otherwise, they're basically saying, yeah, we'll align with you. We'll bring it in 25-26, and you can spend a maximum of 70% of your revenue on football spend.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by
law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. So we stack up pretty well still on that. I think it's hard to, you can't give an exact one, but people like I say, the real experts, like your Kieran Maguire's, your Swiss Rambles, they've estimated anywhere between 55-65% currently for us. So we're well below the 70%, and we've got 2 years to play with, hopefully grow revenues, get back into the Champions League, that sort of thing. So yeah, we're pretty good. There are clubs that it doesn't let everyone off the hook, like Newcastle are well above 100%, so they've got a big problem on their hands with this.
What do they do, Newcastle? Because it's consistent Champions League football, it feels like, because Newcastle isn't a hotbed for, in the way that, and I'll ask you questions about how we're monetizing the stadium as a thing, as an object. But Newcastle have different challenges up in the north. It's not like London. It's not like how do you think they're going to go about doing it?
It's tough because they don't want to do it the slow way. Is the problem? Like, if they wanted to do it properly, the new owners would, build them a 100,000 seat stadium, do what we're doing, host other events there, try and get in the Champions League regularly, like invest in youth players because that doesn't count towards PSR, and just sort of, it might take 3, 5 years, 10 years, as we've seen, but you'll bring the revenues up. But what they've done is tried to artificially do it, so they've stuffed in a few sort of, dodgy sponsorship deals with Saudi Airlines and that sort of thing. And they've tried to bump their revenue up as high as they can. They've done all the spending they can up to the current limits. And now that's why they're looking at, we might have to sell Bruno, we might have to sell Isaac. So they're basically going to have to go into a model like we did, where you get a bail, you buy them young, you get them good, you sell them like Isaac, Bruno. They might just have to take the hit and reinvest the money, basically.
Yeah, so when they said, we might have to sell Isaac, it's because, it's not because they are... there's no room for them to operate. It's not because they're close to breaching FFP, or they will be when these new rules come in. Do they have to be under 70% by the time these, or 90% rather, in like the season after next?
Yeah, it's 90% now, 8% next year, and 70% season after. So by 25-6, they have to be at 70%. Yeah.
Oh really?
So they're almost. I mean, I don't know how you would reach that without either massively inflating revenues, which is difficult to do that quickly, or massively reducing your costs. So they've either got to raise a lot more money, probably through player sales, or they've got to somehow bring the cost down. So it's basically player sales. It's how they're going to have to do it and just try and increase revenues. And the weird thing about it is the rule, we've also tweaked it in the Premier League. So 70% is your blanket rule. But we've also said, actually, what we're going to do, any club that's not in Europe, you can have 85%. So you actually get a little bit more wiggle room if you're not in Europe, which ironically means Newcastle would be better off not in Europe. Like, it means the Conference League becomes a real poison chalice because you've got your 70% limit, but you don't get the revenue for it. So end of next season, you might have Newcastle and Villa clearly actively trying to avoid it, whereas clubs like Brighton would be fine because they're profitable, they're fine. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, that is fascinating. It's a bit of an unstabling of the competition. You can't have teams actively not trying to finish in seventh spot so they don't have to go in the competition. Surely they should change the rules and not make it blanket European competition, but make it Champions League qualification, because the other two don't generate enough money to make it worthwhile, like you say.
Yeah, you'd think that'd be more sensible, or even like 70% Champions League and like 75% Europa or 80% Europa or something like that. And then nothing for Conference League, because you basically get nothing for the Conference League, like money-wise. It's going to be strange to watch, because I'm not sure who's going to want to qualify for it other than Brighton. Because these rules really hurt you, like your aspirational clubs, they call them, like Newcastle and Villa and teams like that, who have got high costs, but they don't have the revenues of the top five or six. So they're sort of in a weird zone where they're just about managing with the current thing. But when you move to quad cost rule, they're gonna struggle. So they've got to bring their costs down. I think I saw a graph that someone had done, and Newcastle the worst. I've pasted it here. Chelsea are about 90%, they reckon. United are close to 90% as well. Arsenal and Villa are both 75-80%. So yeah, they're the clubs that that have got a bit of a problem. They've got a bit of a belt tightening to do. Whereas Liverpool just under, City just under, we're comfortably under, West Ham, Brighton are all right. So yeah, it's those clubs in that zone, really.
I was going to ask you a question about Arsenal later, because they seem to have spent a huge amount of money and not brought in a lot through player sales. And I was wondering how close they were to breaching. Under the current rules, I'm sure they're fine, but in this squad revenue, what did you call it? Squad cost rule. Like you said, that if in 2 years they're still over.
Yeah.
Or even if they're not over, and it's not about punishment, it's that belt tightening that needs to happen to ensure they're compliant.
Yeah. So they're just under current, I think. I don't know, obviously, their finances as well as ours, but they're, as the last accounts, they were just under. They had to be a little bit careful. Obviously, they spent a lot of money last summer, and then they got to the end of it, wanted to buy Raya. Couldn't do it, so I got him on loan instead. Mm. And they basically deferred the cost for that because they were approaching the limits, and that's why they didn't do anything in January either. So they're a bit like United in terms of they're pretty much there, but they're not in danger of breaching, but they haven't got that much wiggle room.
So is it fair to say that they've speculated on this squad and that the speculation ends and they'll you can see I'm clashing at straws here. They'll only be able to spend what comes in through player sales, and obviously Premier League money.
Yeah, I do think they will spend a bit because obviously they've finally got back in the Champions League this year, so they're going to have that extra money on this year's accounts. And that's the interesting thing that you'll see this summer and every summer going forward now is that most clubs end their financial years at the end of June. We've seen it in the last couple of summers. So clubs are going to have like two deadline days. You're going to have the June one where clubs who have got an excess like us are thinking, right, we sold Harry Kane in this financial year. We've got, we're going to be booking a big profit, so we can afford to eat up some of that and buy a couple of players. You've also got the clubs who need to sell, like Everton sold us Richarlison, Forest sold Johnson. You got Chelsea people who will panic. Chelsea this summer, I'll be amazed if Chelsea don't sell at least one player by June. They'll probably breach anyway. Chelsea got a big hole.
How much do they have to, do you know, is there a figure about what they have to bring in? Because someone said 105, 120 million.
Yeah, that's the figure that's been thrown around. I don't know if it's muddied by, did you see this thing about the hotel where they've sold a hotel to themselves for 70 million odds? I did see that.
Is that, Simon Jordan was saying that as long as it's, not that they haven't broken the rules, there's nothing wrong with it. But it does feel like, how can you sell yourself?
It feels iffy to me, because it's the same group, but they didn't vote to ban like affiliated transfers and affiliated transactions between, related companies and stuff. So I don't think they're breaching any rules from the look of it, but it doesn't feel right. Apparently they've even retained like a licensing thing where they still get the revenue from it. So the club gets the revenue, but can also sell it, which seems mad. But
it does seem straight crazy.
But yeah, they do need to sell still, I think, by June. And if that helps them, even if that helps them to the tune of 70 million, they've still probably got a 30, 40 million pound hole to plug before the end of June. A
Gallagher shaped hole, probably.
A kind of Gallagher shaped hole, yeah, exactly. So he's the one.
And that's because this pure profit exists with homegrown players only. And that is because no transfer fee was paid for them. There's nothing owed on that player. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So it's another thing where it gets quite complicated with the current rules, or actually it'll be with the future rules as well. It's basically an accounting concept that comes into it. So if you sell a player, you sell, actually let's go with buy first. So say you buy a player, say we buy Richarlison for 50 million, put him on a 5-year contract. On our books, it doesn't come out as you've spent 50 million this year. It comes out as, right, you spent 50, that asset, the player is here for 5 years. So they bring in a concept called depreciation, straight line depreciation or amortization in football, that says after 1 year, we'll divide the total amount you spent by the amount of years you're going to have the asset. So after 1 year, he loses 10 million, next year, 10 million, next year, 10 million. So that 50 million is divided into equal chunks. And each year on your books, you'll have a charge basically of £10 million for that player for the next 5 years. So what Chelsea did, thinking they were clever, was we're going to give everyone 8-year contracts, and then that amortization amount comes down. So rather than, Mudrick was what, 88 million or something like that, rather than over 8 years, rather than have that over 5 years, and every year there's a charge of like 15 million, which is a loss, basically, you've got to account for a 15 million on your books, mm-hmm. we will we'll do that over 10 years or 8 years, whatever it was, and it'll be 8 million or 10 million a year. So it'll be less every year. So they did that with all their players, spent all the money up front, but that's why it wasn't a huge accounting loss. But what they have done now is meant that every year for the next 8 or 10 years, they've got, I think it's £200 million amortization bill. So before they even start, before they even do anything else, they need to put aside £200 million in revenue.
I thought it was
just to match that.
I didn't realize it was that much. I thought it was about 75. Not that I don't know where I got that figure from, but I thought it was 75. And even 75 is insane. So if it's even higher. And the thing is what was crazy about the way they went about their business is it was almost as if they didn't understand the sport and the fragility of a player's form. And how mercurial some of these players can be. And you're committing yourself to 8 years. So if Mudryk continues to perform at the level he has, you're paying him a huge salary over an 8 year period, plus the transfer fee. And you've got a player that is worth half of what you paid. If that happens times five, you're in trouble.
That happens with Enzo and everyone else they've signed, and Jackson up front or whoever else. And that's what they've gambled on. They've gambled on basically like these players will come good and we'll get back into the Champions League. Probably because they thought there'd be a fifth spot, which we all thought. Yeah. So they probably thought, we'll probably get back in. We'll get the revenue from that. We'll be able to sell all our homegrown players. And that comes back to your point about the pure profit is the problem they've got with these players is because that player, let's take Richarlison as another example. We've had him 2 years. So on our from an accounting perspective, he's worth about 30 million. If we sell him for any less, it goes down as a loss. Yeah. So this is why we can't just rip up Ndombele's contract, because not only do you pay him the rest of his wages, but you take a loss because you're just giving away an asset that's worth
from an accounting perspective, that's not good. It puts us in a less advantageous position when trying to do transfer deals.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what Chelsea are in now, because they've given all these long contracts. They thought they were clever. Mudryk's still worth £80 million on their books this summer. So unless they sell him for more than 80, it doesn't help them from a financial perspective. It just books as a loss. So they can't, because they're underperforming, they can't sell them either,
which is why they're looking at their homegrown players and that's what they have to sell. Yeah. I don't know if you saw this clip. I was on, there's a program called The Overlap, which is Gary Neville's thing. And I was got into this very surreal argument with Jamie Carragher about, they were saying ethically it's not right that clubs have to sell their homegrown players. And I was saying, my point was that it doesn't matter about the ethics. This is accounting. The homegrown players are worth so much more than the players that they've brought in for the reasons we've just discussed. And they were incredulous with this idea that homegrown players shouldn't be the answer to solving debt in or profit and sustainability.
The thing is, as you say, it's an accounting concept. So like they didn't have a buy price. So all of that is 100% profit. It all goes on your book straight away. Clubs don't need to get themselves in the position where they have to sell. Like that's up to the clubs. Like if Chelsea didn't go out and spend £1.5 billion on players, they wouldn't need to go and sell, Gallagher and Colwell and whoever else they're going to have to sell. Reece James. But like that's their choice to go and spaff all their money on, Enzo Fernandez and Mudryk, instead of just saying, actually, we won't do that. And we'll keep, we know what the rules are. We just won't fall foul of them. And then we'll keep Conor Gallagher or whoever it was they want to keep.
You said earlier that we Spurs' sort of buffer, our headroom is around 205 million as it stands, approximately around that figure, right?
Yeah.
Are Tottenham cash rich? So if there was a world where we could spend 205 million on incoming players, plus whatever money we got from the Premier League and sales, so that 205 million would be on top of money we'd bring in and are able to spend, i.e. through player sales or like Premier League TV money or whatever else it might come. If we're in that situation, do we have £205 million in the bank to spend?
So that's probably the important distinction, is that we have that headroom as of June last year. We have, as in we could have spent an extra or could have made another £200 million in losses up to last June. But that doesn't necessarily equate to the cash we've got. Coincidentally, we have got a decent amount of cash in the bank. I think it's around 200 million, which is the highest in the league. So it does actually match up quite nicely, but that's just pure coincidence. It's I don't know why we've got so much cash. It could either be because we need to keep it. I asked a mate about this who is an accountant, and he said we might need to keep it because of debt, like agreements in our debt to finance the stadium, so that you can, if you people on some of those.
Show that you've got the cash.
You've got the money there.
Yeah.
So it might be that, but it also might be that our transfer fees owed, we owe a lot of money. We do a lot of spending on credit, so we don't give much up front, which surprised me a little bit, because I think if you've got the cash there, you could sweeten the deal, bring the price down by chucking some cash at them, because everyone's tight for money at the moment. But yeah, we haven't done that. We've kept the money in the bank. It went down a bit from last season, but it's still, I mean, the next closest is Man United, Man City, and the sort of 70 million cash in the bank, whereas we've got 200 million sitting in an account somewhere, club account. Not really doing much, but it's either that or it's the transfers. Like I say, we owe a lot of money, and maybe over the next year or two, that figure's going to come down because we owe, we've got to give 10 million to Leon for Ndombele and 10 million to whoever else. So we might see that figure come down as money.
We still owe money for Ndombele, do we?
Probably. I'd like to think that, probably, yeah.
Oh, God, does that go down at the worst transfer you've ever seen in the Premier League? Could be.
It's got to be, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think someone added it up the other day. It's 150 million altogether it's cost us, which shows you the damage it does.
Yeah, we cost... Well, I just totted up how much we've paid him in transfers, in wages.
Yeah.
Or has gone into his bank since becoming a Tottenham player. It might be through money from Napoli and Galatasaray and Lyon when he went back. But it was around £50 million in wages. Crazy. Absolutely crazy.
Painful, isn't it?
Yeah. Why are we looking for fresh investment then? Is it about just having a cash flow in, spending money on transfers that doesn't come out of the club's books? Is it as simple as that?
Yeah, it could be. There's either two reasons they're probably doing it. So one will be that they want to sell some of their shares. So like you said earlier, they make their money when they sell some of their whatever they currently own, 75% of their shares. So they might be saying, actually, we're going to give 10% to some American investment company or whoever it might be. They then get 10% of the club, but we pocket the money. So basically, they're just selling their own shares. They get the money. They walk off and they're happy with their, whatever it is, £300 million. But or it could be that they're creating new shares, which is what they did. Do you remember, was it last season or season before? They did a capital investment, which means created new shares, and they basically gave the club 100. Yeah, that's it. And they gave the club 100, and they've for some reason held back 50. I'm not sure if the plan is to use that or not.
So what when they did that, because we just thought as fans, oh, brilliant, that's £150 million that we're going to get on transfers. Is that where, did it go into the cash? Did it go into the bank account for the cash?
It goes into the club, and it's just spread around on whatever stuff we spend on. So but it does count towards, in our accounts that year, that would have been an extra 100 million counted as, money coming in. So that would have helped from a profitability perspective. Yeah. And that's what I thought they might do with the other 50, is use that this year because we weren't in the Champions League to say, let's boost the profits up this year. But so far, there's no word of that.
So as long as you're selling shares, that's acceptable revenue generation for spending.
Yeah, if you're creating new shares, then it sort of dilutes what all the existing shares are worth a tiny bit, but not by much. So they created some shares, they gave us 100, and they might be doing that again. They might be saying, look, we want to bring in fresh money to the club. We don't want to do it out of our own pocket, but this Saudi prince or whoever it might be wants to give us 300 million. We'll create, however many, 10,000 new shares, and we'll just give him those shares, and they're worth this much money.
So
that might be what they're doing.
So they won't. It wouldn't be Enoch giving up percentage of their shares, they'll be creating new ones.
That's the best case scenario for us as fans, is that they create new ones, sell them, and the money then goes into the club rather than to Enoch. Whereas if they're selling their own shares, all they're doing is giving up some of their control, but the money that goes to them, not the club. So yeah, so we want the creating new shares option.
Right, that's important to note. So if Enoch sell a part of theirs, it goes into the business, not into Tottenham. If they create shares, the money goes into the club. Okay.
Yeah.
A lot of noise has been made about Beyonce concerts and F1 karting. And how significant do you think that revenue is across the season? And in your opinion, does it make us genuinely stronger in the transfer market?
Yeah, it definitely makes us stronger. So our revenue, like I say, our cost went up, but our revenue went up massively. It was up like 107 million. So it went up from 400 and something to 550. Events helped with that massively because commercial revenue was the biggest growth area in our revenue, so that went up by 44 million, which is now it's up at 230 odd million pounds, and for the first time that's our biggest earner. It's 41% of our revenue now, so we earn more from commercial, which includes things like sponsorship, stadium events, merchandise, all that sort of stuff. That's now our biggest earner, above, like, we're in the Champions League for that season. Obviously we got knocked out by AC Milan, but we were in it, and we earn more money from commercial than we did from Champions League or from Premier League revenue, or anything like that.
In terms of revenue, it's like having Champions League money every single time.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, it's basically it's almost like a buffer. Like, we can not be in Europe and still make good money and still spend. And that's what it's all been about, in my opinion, is you get to a position where they don't need to put their own money in. Not that they generally do, but they don't need to. The club can be self-sufficient, can spend quite a lot of money. And also the value of their asset goes up and up. So it ticks all the boxes from their perspective. But that commercial revenue now is absolutely key. And that's why, like, Madrid are building a new stadium. United want to build a new stadium. Like, we're going to, was it another 20 events or something they're trying to get approval
that's
for?
Right,
so,
yeah.
So, I mean, that should just go up, that figure. It's been going up. It should go up more. That should insulate us from not getting in the Champions League.
So we're not maxed out on our revenue generation. There's room to grow.
Yeah, there'll be room to grow. It varies how much, because the models, I'm not sure all the models are, in terms of, like, sometimes they get a flat fee at the start and they don't get the money from, you know, what they sell on the day and stuff. And other ones they get, like the NFL, I think it's like that. You get a certain amount per year and then they take all the money on the gates and things like that. But yeah, I mean, that should grow, because they want to do more NFL games, then we'll do more events, then we'll do, so that could go up another, you know, 30, 40, 50 million in the next couple of years. And then that means another, you know, big chunk of spending power.
In terms of revenue generation, is there any other clubs doing what we're doing? Like,
in the Premier League?
In terms of numbers, are we outliers?
Oh, in terms of overall revenue, we're pretty good. We're still not caught up. We're above Arsenal now. We're above Chelsea. We're still, Man United are a revenue machine. Like, yeah. they still make loads of money, like, globally from shirts and stuff. Man City as well. You know, you can debate how they've got there, and some of it's artificial, but, like, all their sponsorship deals and stuff, but they make a lot of money as well. We're not that far behind Liverpool anymore. So we've gone from a place where we were, I think, only 5 or 10 years ago, we were like a couple hundred million behind Arsenal for revenue. We're now something like 70, 100 million ahead of them for revenue. So we've climbed pretty quickly, and now we're able to compete with pretty much everyone other than the two Manchester clubs for the money coming in.
So actually, you could argue, and maybe it's in the back of Daniel Levy's mind or at the forefront of his mind, that actually sustained success in the Premier League is a massive revenue maker, because that's what has happened at Man City.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, just getting in the Champions League alone is huge. But yeah, I mean, if you can win stuff as well, and you get the extra money for winning stuff, you're on TV more, so you get more facility payments, you get so much more money if you're successful. And that's why I don't really buy this, we only really want to qualify for Europe, because, yeah, they do. Like, if you're an investment company, you want sustainable revenue, because that drives the price of the asset up. But success would be great for business for them. Like, whether he's a Tottenham fan or not, you know, I don't know. Rumors are that he is. I don't know or particularly care. But, like, it would be good for business if they do better. Like, if we get the Champions League, if we win the title, if we win trophies, that's great for business. That means more sponsorship. That means, like, more time on TV, more TV money. So it's what they would want. They would want success, even just from a pure investment perspective, not from
an emotional one. So people that perhaps accuse Daniel Levy of not wanting to win the league, or not seeking glory, purely from an economic standpoint, it would be foolish for him not to. It would, of course,
it would. The counter argument will be, he doesn't want to spend enough, though. Like, you have to spend a bit more to compete with those teams at top. Like, you have to really push the boat out, and he's only willing to spend enough to sort of almost get there or thereabouts. So that'll be the counter argument. But I think, like, I mean, he's an accountant, isn't he? At the end of the day, he probably sees transfer spending. He probably hates it. He probably sees it as like gambling.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's. I think he's. I mean, this is speculation now, but I think he's recognised that. We've seen changes in the last 2 years where he's actually stepping back a bit from the hands-on management, and he's brought in, you know, these layers beneath him. So, is it Scott Munn's come in? Has Neil Langer's now come in? Mm-hmm. I think he realised some of the decisions we've made in the last 5 years have not helped us from a value perspective or a football perspective, and now he's starting to make some of those changes. So yeah, ultimately, you need to invest money and have good recruitment and probably a better luck as well, and allow some time to successfully, you know, sustainably compete. And we haven't had the money up to the stadium. We've now got that, but we've got to get the on-field, yeah, all the decisions right now. So
So much of it is about making the correct decisions, not just about spending money, as we've seen. And I want to ask you whether or not you think, from someone who's so interested and invested in finances and financial conversations, do you think Daniel Levy is a good chairman? Do you think he's... Are you satisfied with his performance as a Spurs fan?
That's a hard question, isn't it? I'm not at either end of the extremes. Like, I'm not the the purple and gold, for lack of a better word, end of the cycle, or that everything's perfect. And I think like everything, like this, it's grey. Like, people want to see everything in black and white, don't they? He's either terrible or he's good, and he's like, he's the devil, or he's you know, the best chairman in the world. And I think he's somewhere in the middle to me. Like, he's obviously a great businessman. Yes, they did get into it as an investment. But yeah, you look at where, yeah, we both sat through the 90s. Like, we were, what were we, 14th, 16th, 17th every year. We were getting battered, Arsenal in the league. We were nowhere near, were we? So it's undeniable that, like, we've climbed the league. We're much better on the pitch. We're much better off the pitch. So I think actually they've been good for us, but could they have been better? Yeah. Like, they could have, there's key times we know they could have invested more. They could have just pushed the boat out. And this is what I mean. He probably sees it as gambling. Like, he could have gone out and got Suarez instead of, who did we sign? I can't think of Luis Saha. I don't know who it was at the time. Mm. But, like, we could have gone out and got Cahill for not that much. Instead, we got Ryan Nelson. Like, there's little times like that under Redknapp where we were close, under Poch where we were close, where you just think, if you push the boat out a little bit more, maybe we could have taken that final step. So, I think, yeah, he's not perfect.
100% agree with you with that. And I think everybody understands that and accepts it. I think, though, that he has a plan for the future in terms of how he had a plan. When they officially took over and had the full running of the club, I think it was 2006 that happened. They got into Tottenham in 2001, if my dates are correct.
Yeah.
But it wasn't until 2006, actually, that he got control. I'm pretty sure that's correct. Anyway, we're in a situation where I think he had a plan, an overarching plan about what he needed to do in order to get Tottenham to a place where we can generate huge amounts of revenue or challenge for the league title or whatever it might be. Mm. And he wasn't willing to deviate from that overarching plan too much. And a speculation in the wrong time, in his opinion, might have put that long-term plan in jeopardy.
Mm.
And that, I think that's probably where he's come from. And nothing gets in the way of it. Like, the fan sentiment doesn't really get in the way of it. And he's had that idea about what he wants to do and how we achieve success. And for him, as a businessman, as a part of his investment company, success is revenue building and profitability. It just doesn't sit right for him.
And that goes hand in hand with the football. You know, we've got better on the pitch, we've got in the Champions League, and that's helped the shareholders as well. But yeah, I agree with you. I think he's definitely got his flaws, and he's definitely at times been too much for a micromanager and things like that. But as you say, he had a plan, and ultimately we were behind, like, Everton, Villa, or we were sort of roughly similar to Everton, Villa for finances. Other clubs were miles behind, Liverpool, United, things like that. So you can't just, especially with, like, financial control starting, you can't just say, I'll just spend the money, because we can never spend as much as them. We can never get anywhere near what Liverpool could spend on wages and transfers. Even if there wasn't a PSR, you're basically asking him to either chuck all your own money in or make the club go bankrupt. Like, you literally cannot match them. So we had to make that gap up. And I think, as you say, that's the plan. They didn't want to put their own money in. That's, you know, that's their choice. Some owners do, some don't. So they put a little bit in, and then they basically built us up sustainably, which is pretty impressive. Like, where we've got to is what Everton should have been doing, you know, 20 years ago, and what Villa could have been doing and things like that. So we've now gone from also around, yeah, mid-table financially to one of the top three or four in the league financially, and with that now we can spend. And whether he knew PSR was going to be this, you know, have this much of an impact or not, anyone's guess, but ultimately it has, and he's put us in a strong position. So yeah, I don't think you can argue he's just terrible for the club and he's not interested in Tottenham doing well, but I do think he's always gonna have one eye on both of the revenues and the asset price, because he's, you know, he is an investor.
Ben, thank you so much.
Yeah, no worries.
Sports Social Podcast Network.